And welcome to this hearing of the D.C. Rental Housing Commission. I am Chairman Michael T. Spencer, and I am joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Lisa M. Gregory and Commissioner Rupa Puttaganta. Today is January 30th, 2019, and the time is 2:05 p.m. We are convened in the Commission's offices, which is located at 441 4th Street Northwest, Suite 1140 B North, Washington, D.C. We're here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. This hearing, noticed at 2 p.m., is in regard to the housing accommodation located at 3012 Pineview Court Northeast in Washington, D.C. Two tenant petitions have been consolidated and numbered as RHTP 1530671 and RHTP 30767. The case is styled Roy L. Pearson Jr., Tenant Appellant versus Gardenia Brown, Housing Provider, Appellee. The Commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the Tenant Appellant.
And good afternoon. My name is Roy Pearson. I am the Tenant Appellant.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Proceeding pro se, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. And as for the Housing Provider, Appellee.
Yes, thank you. My name is Doreen Haney, and I represent Gardenia Brown, the housing provider in this case.
Thank you. I would briefly like to explain the Commission's procedures. Our rules are pretty similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each side will have 20 minutes to present its case, beginning with the tenant appellant. The tenant appellant may preserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the housing provider at police case. Do you have any questions
about it? I raised my eyebrows because on your calendar it said that the oral argument was for 1 hour, so I assume we have a half hour each.
No.
It's only going to be 20 minutes each?
Yes, you're going to have 20 minutes each. So I'll repeat it again. The tenant appellant may preserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the housing provider at police. The housing provider at police must present all of its argument within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In its discretion, the Commission may allow additional time for argument to a party in the event that we engage in questions that occupy a substantial portion of that party's time. The Commission's decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties. In this proceeding, the Commission does not request nor will accept post-hearing submissions from either party. As the clerk of the court has mentioned, I ask that you turn off any cell phones and the other electronic equipment. The Commission is not aware of any preliminary matters in this case. Does either side wish to raise any matters?
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing none, we will proceed with the tenant appellant.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Roy Pearson, and I'm the appellant and tenant petitioner. I hope you will excuse my reading my oral argument to you, but the many demands on my time in the last couple of weeks, and actually months, since my mother's death have not permitted me to commit it to memory or anything like that. And so if you would find reading it yourself to be less tedious than my reading it to you, I'd be happy to simply hand you up a copy of my oral argument, which is already typed up, with the request that it be made a part of the record, and you can let me know when you're finished reading it. It would take about 15 minutes. I have a copy for Ms. Haney, for the record, for Ms. Miles, and a copy for each commissioner.
We'll allow you to read it.
The consolidated tenant petitions in this case are the second set of tenant petitions that I have filed that have reached the commission for a decision. I will therefore refer to the first set of tenant petitions as Pearson 1, I'll refer to the two consolidated tenant petitions in this case as Pearson 2. The principal issue that was presented in Pearson 1 was the lawfulness of my rent level. In Pearson 1, this commission affirmed the OAH's ruling that my housing provider failed to meet her burden of proving my apartment was exempt from rent control, either at the beginning of my tenancy, on October 13, 1999, or at any point prior to the date of the evidentiary hearing in Pearson 1, which took place on October 9, 2014. I should also note that it was undisputed in Pearson 1, as it is in this consolidated case, that my housing provider demanded 12 rent increases over the course of the 15-year period that Pearson 1 covered, and the commission affirmed the OAH's ruling that the maximum allowable rent as a result of my housing provider's failure to prove her she was exempt from rent control was a rent level set by the last of the rent increases taken more than 3 years prior to the date I filed my tenant petition in Pearson 1. I filed my tenant petition in Pearson 1 on February 12, 2014, and the last of the rent increases taken more than 3 years previously increased my rent to $949 per month. Thus, the OAH ruled and the commission affirmed that the maximum allowable rent was $949, and rent overcharges were computed on that basis. In Pearson 1, you reached that determination of the maximum allowable rent for two principal reasons. First, you ruled that a tenant, and not the housing provider, has the burden of proving the maximum allowable rent in a rent challenge case. And two, more importantly, you ruled that I was barred by the statute of limitations, that is in the Rental Housing Act of 1985, from challenging any rent adjustment that had an effective date more than 3 years prior to the date I filed my tenant petition in Pearson 1. After reviewing those two reasons for your ruling in Pearson 1 in preparation for this oral argument, it has become clear to me that the Commission's reasoning in Pearson 1 is perfectly compatible with my argument in Pearson 1 and now in Pearson 2 that the Commission must rule that the maximum allowable rent throughout my now 19-year tenancy was and is $0.00 per month. And so for the first 15 minutes of my argument today, I'd like to explain the reasons why, because I've not had an opportunity to do that since you issued your decision in Pearson 1. And you did that on May 3, 2018. I filed my brief in this case on October 27, 2017, some 6 months previously before that. So at the outset, I'd just like to stipulate, although this is just for purposes of demonstrating how synchronized I believe my reasoning is with that of the commission in Pearson 1, that a tenant who challenges his rent level has the burden of proving that his rent level exceeds the maximum allowable rent for his rental unit. And I will stipulate that that burden of proof remains with the tenant at all times. However, I hope you will agree with me that every tenant in the District of Columbia enjoys one legal presumption. And that legal presumption is that his rental apartment is covered by rent control. And additionally, a tenant enjoys a legal advantage of knowing that if a housing provider claims an exemption from rent control, the housing provider has a burden of proving that exemption from rent control. Both of those legal realities are relevant in every case in which a tenant challenges both his base rent as well as the rent increases during his tenancy, as I did in both Pearson 1 and Pearson 2. And so when a tenant presents a rent overcharge case before the OAH, the tenant's prima facie case consists of only two things. One, that his original rent did not comply with the requirements for establishing a base rent under rent control. And two, that none of the rent increases taken during his tenancy complied with the requirements for taking a rent increase under rent control. I presented just that prima facie case in both Pearson 1 and Pearson 2 by introducing into evidence three things. First, the claim of exemption form or document my housing provider filed with the Department of Housing and Community Development on January 15, 1997, but failed to provide to me before I signed my lease, which I did some 1.5 years later on October 13, 1999. Two, a lease showing that my initial rent was $585 per month. And three, my 12 rent increase notices, none of which met any of the requirements for raising the rent of an apartment under rent control. That then was prima facie proof that from the very beginning of my tenancy, starting with the setting of my initial rent level, my rent at all times exceeded the maximum allowable rent under rent control. And my evidence was not barred by the statute of limitations, because the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense that the housing provider is required to assert and to then present evidence of to meet her burden of proving that my claims are time barred during her rebuttal case. Once I made out my prima facie case, the housing provider had a twofold obligation. First, since she claimed an exemption from rent control, she had the burden of proving her exemption from rent control. However, when she took the stand in this case and in Pearson 1, the housing provider conceded that she had not taken the steps necessary to exempt my apartment from rent control during my tenancy. As a result of that concession and her consequent failure to rebut my prima facie case, as a matter of law, I proved that my initial rent of $585 per month was illegal and that none of the rent increases taken during my tenancy complied with the requirements for taking a rent increase under rent control. In other words, by effectively conceding that her claim of exemption was void, it followed as a matter of law that my initial rent level was illegal because unless you are exempt from rent control, you cannot just unilaterally set an initial rent at any level you wish, unless I were your very first tenant. And the record in Pearson 1 and Pearson 2 showed that I was not the first tenant to rent that property. There are statutes and regulations that spell out how the initial rent level must be set for a rent-controlled apartment, and the housing provider produced no evidence, either Pearson 1 or Pearson 2, that those requirements were met in calculating my initial rent. And I explained this in my brief in Pearson 1 and Pearson 2. In Camacho versus 1440 Rhode Island Avenue Corporation, a 1989 decision of this court, of this commission, ruled that when a housing provider fails to register his property as rent control, fails to register it, it is the housing provider's burden to present other evidence, since it's not registration statement, other evidence of a lawful rent under rent control. But the key thing to realize about Camacho is that whether that burden is viewed as a burden of persuasion or a burden of production, the result is identical. As the commission ruled in Smith Property Holdings Consulate LLC versus Lutzko, a 2015 decision of this commission at page 42, when, quote, a housing provider is not entitled to rely on a claim of exemption, she must adhere to the rent stabilization provisions of the Act. And so in the absence of any evidence of a lawful rent under rent control, as you ruled in Caruso, the maximum allowable rent is zero. The language of the Rental Housing Act statute of limitation requires that same result. Effectiveness is a key to triggering the running of the statute of limitations in the Rental Housing Act. Statute of limitations is located at D.C. Code Section Title 423502.06E, and it only bars me from challenging a rent adjustment, quote, more than 3 years after the effective date of a rent adjustment. But a rent adjustment or rent increase that is void ab initio can never be effective. None of the rent increases in my case were ever effective because the claim of exemption on which they were based was void ab initio, and thus the rent increases never took legal effect. So the three-year statute of limitations in D.C. Code Title 423502.06E never began to run in Pearson 1 or in Pearson 2. Now, the commission did not address that indisputable legal proposition in Pearson 1, but it is settled law in the District of Columbia and throughout the United States of America. Any action that is taken based on a document that is void ab initio, whether that document is a contract, a divorce decree, a deed to property, a judgment entered by a court, a statute enacted by a legislature, or in my case, a claim of exemption from rent control, has no legal effect. And that has been the law in the District of Columbia since at least 1932, which is when the D.C. Circuit announced that rule of law in Free versus Free, found at 59 F. 2nd, 1046. And any decision by the D.C. Circuit handed down before May 1, 1971, such as Free versus Free, can only be overruled by our D.C. Court of Appeals through an en banc decision. And no en banc decision has overruled Free versus Free. Additionally, in the case of In Re Estate of Daryl Randall, found at 999 Atlantic 2nd, 51, a 2010 decision of the D.C. Court of Appeals, the court ruled additionally that by holding, added on to this rule, by holding that you don't need a legal ruling for a document to be void ab initio. It is void ab initio at all times, even before there is a legal ruling to that effect. In other words, the housing provider's claim of exemption and the rent increases based on it did not become void as a result of the OH's decision in Pearson 1 in December of 2014, because in In Re Estate of Daryl Randall, the D.C. Court of Appeals held that even if I had not filed a tenant petition, all rent increases were still at all times be void ab initio. And when it comes to statute of limitations in particular, every court decision that I have found that has addressed the issue has specifically ruled that the time period in a statute of limitations, when a statute that sets the time for taking an appeal, for that matter, does not begin running if the judgment being appealed from or the law containing the time limitation is void ab initio. In my brief, I cited Chandler versus Zoning Hearing Board of Weisberg Township, found at 850 Atlantic 2nd, 619, a 2004 Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision, as one of a number of examples of that principle that's uniform across the United States. So the statute of limitations in the Rental Housing Act was not triggered in Pearson 1 or Pearson 2. I was free to challenge each of the 12 rent increases the housing provider demanded in my case.
Mr. Pearson, I'm sorry, let me interrupt you quickly. First, I apologize. I forgot to ask if you would like to preserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
No.
Okay. So you have approximately 10 more minutes for your argument. And secondly, most importantly, I should have did this at the onset to express our condolences for your loss of your mother as well. Okay. So with that, feel free to proceed.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Predictable. If you mention my mother's death, it's unpredictable how I'll react. Just give me just a second, please.
Would you like to take a 5 minute break?
Just take a second. Just take a second.
My apologies. I just wanted to recognize what you mentioned at the onset of the hearing and acknowledge that.
Okay. And I was also free to challenge my initial or base rent level, thank you, of $585 because the Rental Housing Act statute of limitations for challenges to base rents is triggered only when a housing provider has filed a base rent. In that case, DC Code Title 423502.06E and 14 DCMR 4215.2 give me 6 months thereafter in which to file a tenant petition challenging that base rent. And a housing provider can only file a base rent when they register a property under rent control. In both Pearson 1 and Pearson 2, was undisputed that my housing provider never registered my apartment as rent control, so the 6 months has not begun to run, and I was free, as I did, to challenge my initial or base rent of $585 as well. But even if my initial rent level could be considered a rent adjustment, that adjustment never took legal effect because it, too, was void. Because it, too, was based on a claim of exemption that was void ab initio. Without that exemption from rent control, the housing provider in this case could not simply choose any initial rent she wished because it was undisputed in Pearson 1 and in these consolidated cases that I was not her first tenant. As a consequence, my maximum allowable rent level has been $0.00 since the day I signed my lease. On the subject of what the housing provider should have done after she failed to serve me with her claim of exemption, the Rental Housing Act and its regulations spell out the correct procedure. And the first thing she was required to do by 14 DCMR 4103.1B was to file an amended registration under rent control. And that same regulation required that she do so within 30 days after she failed to provide me with written notice of her claim to exemption from rent control way back in October of 1999. And to calculate the maximum allowable rent to write into that amended registration, she would follow the formula set forth in DC Code Title 423502.09A. It states you start with the base rent. The base rent, according to 14 DCMR 3501.03, is a rent legally charged or chargeable on April 30, 1985. And DC Code Title 423509.09A says you add to that figure any increases authorized after April 30, 1985. In the case of my housing provider, who began renting my apartment in 1994, some 5 years before I moved in, she would begin with the lawful rent she charged her first tenant in 1994 and add to it the amount of all lawful increases prior to my tenancy in 1999. That then would be the maximum allowable rent, or rent charged under rent control. And it would be effective the day after my tenancy began on October 14, 1999. And that's what Title 42, 3502.06A provides. There is another way to calculate a maximum allowable rent that may appear to, but does not apply to my facts. DC Code Title 42, 3502.08A and 14 DCMR 4203.6 detail how to calculate the rent charge for a rental unit, quote, upon the expiration or termination of the exemption. But there has to be an exemption. There was no exemption in this case because it was void ab initio at all times. That is unlike the case, for example, when a housing provider owns four rental units and then purchases a fifth rental unit, so she's no longer a small housing provider and is no longer exempt from rent control. In that case, the original exemption was not void ab initio. So that's what that statute and that regulation applies to, not my instance where it was void ab initio. And so it was undisputed in Pearson 1, just as it is in this case, that the landlord did not meet her burden of production, not persuasion, production. She presented no evidence that either my initial rent was calculated in accordance with rent control requirements or that any of the rent increases she subsequently demanded were taken in compliance with rent control requirements. So because my prima facie case went unchallenged, I met my burden in Pearson 1 and Pearson 2 of proving that the maximum allowable rent at all times in my tenancy was $0.00. And the relief I'm entitled to is spelled out in DC Code Title 42, 3509.01, which states that any person who demands a rent in excess of the maximum allowable shall be held liable by either the rent administrator or this commission for the amount of rent exceeds the applicable rent charged. I am therefore due an award of all rent that has been demanded of me since my tenancy began, because those demands exceeded the $0.00 per month that the housing provider's admissions and her complete lack of rebuttal evidence conceded my maximum allowable rent to be. I think it's important to note that this is the same result that would follow in any other administrative hearing where a consumer has challenged charges by a regulated business. If, for example, Pepco, Washington Gas, or the water company failed to meet their burden of production, of producing any rebuttal evidence at all of a lawful electricity, gas, or water charge, the consumer who has made out a prima facie case of overcharges would prevail, and the regulated business would receive $0.00 in payment. The D.C. Court of Appeals most recently explained how these different evidentiary burdens, the difference between the burden of production and the burden of persuasion, works in an administrative setting in the case of Gatewood versus D.C. Water and Sewer Authority, found at 82 Atlantic 3rd, 41, on pages 51, 52, and notes 59 through 60. It's a very recent 2013 decision of the D.C. Court of Appeals. And speaking of the D.C. Court of Appeals, it is required to affirm rulings of this commission unless it concludes that the commission's ruling is arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or it's otherwise not in accordance with law. Needless to say, a decision that ignores Free versus Free, In Re Estate of Daryl Randall, and Gatewood versus District of Columbia Water and Sewer Authority would not be in accordance with law. And for that reason, I respectfully request that the commission amend your decision in Pearson 1, which is still pending before the commission, and that you adopt the reasoning I have outlined in this argument for both Pearson 1 and Pearson 2 to set a maximum allowable rent for 3012 Pineview Court Northeast from October 13, 1999 to the date of your decision at $0.00 per month. In that regard, I would note that on December 31, 2018, I filed tenant appellant citation of supplemental authority with the commission. In that filing, I cited the commission's decision in Redmond versus Maherly Management, Inc., a March 26, 2002 decision of the commission. In Redmond, two different hearing examiners had dismissed the tenant's petition alleging rent overcharges, a reduction in services, improper registration, and retaliatory conduct. The first hearing examiner concluded that all of those claims were barred by the statute of limitations. On remand, after the commission reversed that decision, the second hearing examiner denied the tenant's petition on its merits. On appeal from the second decision, this commission did not just reverse the hearing examiner. You found that none of his major findings of fact were supported by substantial evidence in the record. and you conducted your own review of the record and announced your own findings of fact. And based on those findings, you awarded the tenant a refund for a reduction in services, as well as rental overcharges, as well as treble damages, and interest on all of those rent overcharges. And you imposed a fine for the housing provider's violation of the Rental Housing Act's registration requirements. You also imposed a fine because of a housing provider's retaliatory conduct, and you rolled the tenant's rent back. So Redmond conclusively demonstrates that you have the statutory authority, in rent overcharge cases at least, to make your own findings of fact and to determine liability, damages, and the amount of interest due a tenant. No remand is necessary for any of those purposes. The remaining issues presented by this appeal include whether the OAH erred in approximately 23 other respects having to do with retaliation, treble damages, the civil fines for service of an illegal notice to vacate, entry of cease and desist orders, a referral to the U.S. Attorney, referral to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. In total, pages 230 through 234 of my brief requested decision addresses and provides relief with respect to 25 matters. I'm prepared to allow my brief to speak for itself on those matters because, unlike the recent decision handed down in Pearson 1, I think you'll agree with me that I comprehensively briefed all other issues in the case. However, if you have any questions regarding that, I certainly would be happy to address them.
Thank you. Ready?
Thank you, Commissioners. Again, my name is Doreen Haney, and I represent Gardenia Brown in this matter.
Excuse me. I'm going to need you to probably pull the microphone a little closer to you so we can make sure we capture it on the recording. Thank you.
Thank you. These two tenant petitions were primarily in the beginning about two things. The first one, 3671, alleged a defective 90-day notice for personal use and occupancy. The second one, 3767, alleged acts of retaliation, and there were some acts of retaliation alleged in the petition itself, and then there were other acts of retaliation that Mr. Pearson attempted to present into evidence at the hearing. The claim of rent increases was added to these tenant petitions by Judge Vergeer because Mr. Pearson wanted to challenge rent increases from the date of his hearing in the first two petitions, which was in August or October of 2014, and the date of the actual decision. Or dates after that. And so Judge Vergeer gave him the opportunity to add that claim for rent increases to these two petitions. That's the only reason why that issue's even here. But there were no additional rent increases during the period of time covered by the amendment to these two petitions. The last rent increase that was covered by any of these petitions took place in early 2014. So the whole issue of rent increases and whether or not and what the rent level should be was decided twice. It was decided in the first set of tenant petitions, and this court or this commission affirmed that decision, and then it was decided by the Office of Administrative Hearings for the appropriate time period in this particular case. And Mr. Pearson made the same most of the same arguments that he makes now there too, and they were rejected. They've been rejected now three times. I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time on this whole issue of base rents, but simply to say this. Ms. Brown filed a claim of exemption in 1997. She filed another claim of exemption in 2010 because she had been asked by Mr. Pearson to serve him with a notice to quit because he couldn't pay the rent so that he could go to an agency. When she went to file the claim of exemption, she realized that she needed a housing business license, which she didn't have before. So it was actually at Mr. Pearson's instigation that she filed this second claim of exemption. And she didn't mail it to him at the same time. That's why he was awarded all the the rent increases that he's been awarded in all of these tenant petitions because she didn't mail it to him. But that doesn't mean that once she that because her claim of exemption was found to be invalid by Judge Vergeer, that she has to refile as covered by rent control. That's not true. It's undisputed that she qualifies on at least one basis, probably two, for this unit to be exempt from rent control. It's the only rental unit she owns in the District of Columbia. And what is supposed to happen if your claim of exemption is invalidated and you as a housing provider have a valid right to be exempt from rent control under the law is set forth in Levy versus Carmel Partners, which Judge Vergeer relied on to say that she can file a new claim of exemption, an amended claim of exemption, and serve it on the tenant appropriately. And at that point, then, she will be appropriately covered by rent. She will be appropriately exempt from rent control. And in this case, Judge Vergeer found that she had in fact done that at the end of 2016. And so the law sets forth what is supposed to happen when the claim of exemption is invalidated. Judge Vergeer mentioned that in his final order in the first two tenant petitions. Ms. Brown filed a new claim of exemption, served it appropriately, that's not disputed, and then she raised the rent back to 1386, which is what it had been before the rent increases were invalidated. And this last increase, Mr. Pearson doesn't challenge that portion of Judge Vergeer's ruling in this tenant petition, in this appeal. He doesn't mention it at all, except to say now for the first time that this increase in 2016 was one of 45 or 48 retaliatory acts for which he's seeking fines. So this entire discussion of base rent simply doesn't apply. Ms. Brown learned what to do from the first decision in the first two tenant petitions, and she did it. And it isn't challenged. So there's no need to discuss base rents or all of the laws involving base rents. It's undisputed she didn't file for base rent. She was exempt. The law doesn't require her to do that when she's exempt. And she believed herself to be exempt up until Judge Vergeer said in his final order in October, his proposed final order in October of 2016, that her claim of exemption was invalid. And he himself found in this decision, the decision that's on appeal now, that was indeed the case, that the claim of exemption was presumptively valid. She had a reason to believe it was valid until she was told that it wasn't. Now, Mr. Pearson does make an argument based on this Camacho case, and he made that argument before this commission in the last appeal. Unfortunately, he didn't make it below in the last two tenant petitions, and so this commission decided not to entertain it because it was being made for the first time on appeal. In this case, Mr. Pearson didn't really raise the issue of this argument except in one small portion of his closing argument, which he submitted in writing before the Office of Administrative Hearings, so it's part of the record. But I did address it in my brief. He only mentions it briefly here, but I'd like to point out that nothing in Camacho says that the rent should be zero. Again, this is a situation where what is alleged is that the housing provider didn't register at all. There was no suggestion that the housing provider had a legitimate claim of exemption from rent control. And so this just simply doesn't apply. If the housing provider in Camacho was unable to show that it was legitimately a hotel, then they would have to show that they had filed for their base rents and rent ceilings. And again, like many of the cases upon which Mr. Pearson relies, the Camacho case was decided before rent ceilings were abolished. And the whole filing scheme is different now, but it doesn't matter because Ms. Brown wasn't required to file base rents. There are two other things that I want to address with respect to Mr. Pearson's newest appeal. One of them is his claim of willfulness and his entitlement to treble damages. And he makes this claim of willfulness in connection with not only the rent increases, but also with respect to every allegation of retaliatory act, he claims it should be augmented because of willful behavior. And the sole reason that he claims that Ms. Brown engaged in willful behavior is because she did not heed his warnings or respond to his requests regarding her claim of exemption. And I would just like to point out, as I pointed out in my opposition to motion for summary reversal in tenant petitions 3482 and 3555, which has not yet been ruled on, that the things that Mr. Pearson told Ms. Brown about the law were wrong. In his exhibits PX114 and PX115, what Mr. Pearson told Ms. Brown is that she couldn't be exempt from rent control ever because she hadn't provided him with a claim of exemption before he rented the apartment. And he said that this was based on DC code 45-3502.22. Now, in Mr. Pearson's brief, he makes a great deal out of this argument that Ms. Brown could have Googled this statute. She could have found out her obligations. And the first thing that I want to point out is, no, she couldn't, because he cited it wrong. It's not 45-3502.22. And if she tried to Google that, she wouldn't find anything. It's actually 42-3502.22. And it wasn't even in existence when Mr. Pearson moved in 1999. It was passed in 2006. And so stating that this statute provides that she can never raise the rent because she can never be exempt from rent control is just, it's simply incorrect. And if she had heeded his warning and went researching what he said, she wouldn't have found anything of use anyway. Now, with respect to what the statute does require, it does require that disclosures be made available, including the claim of exemption. And Mr. Pearson claims that he, in one of the emails that he sent her, telling her that she could never be exempt because she did it wrong, that she had 10 days to respond to that. But that's untrue as well, because what the statute actually says is that the tenant can make a demand for the claim of exemption and that the housing provider has 10 days to respond and can't raise the rent if the housing provider doesn't respond within 10 days. But there was never a request. All there was this berating her and claiming that all of her rent increases were retaliatory and she was going to be subject to thousands and thousands of dollars in fines. And there was never any request for a copy of the claim of exemption. I think he actually may have gotten it himself. And nor was there ever any indication to her that there was something she could or should be doing in response to his claim. He merely, and in his exhibit PX118A, which was in February of 2014, he basically sets out his settlement demand, which includes $10,000, and he wants the rent rolled back to $585 a month, and he wants to be able to will or assign the rental unit to a relative or a friend when he leaves or dies. None of this is a request for a rent control or a claim of exemption. None of this is something she could have responded to. And so it just can't be true that her failure to respond to these things in the way that he deems appropriate is a willful act, a heedless disregard of duty, and that's what he claims it is. And I don't know that it was pointed out as clearly as I would have hoped in my brief, but heedless disregard of what Mr. Pearson told Ms. Brown it's not her duty. It was all wrong. Now, the majority of these two tenant petitions seem to concern claims of retaliation, and I wanted to just address a few things with regard to the claims of retaliation. Tenant petition 671 deals with improprieties in a 90-day notice to quit, 90-day notice to vacate for personal use and occupancy, and my client did file a lawsuit based on that notice, which was dismissed, and so she wasn't able to obtain possession, and she hasn't tried again, as she testified about this at the hearing. At this point, given the intense nature of the litigation, it just seems like a pointless act. There's just going to be something wrong and more litigation if she tries to get her property back. But again, there was a claim that this was willful and that therefore there should be extra damages. And I think I've addressed that at pretty great length in my brief. With respect to the retaliation claims, they basically break down into a couple of different categories. One was the group of claims that was dismissed on the grounds of res judicata on summary judgment below. And I just wanted to point out what claims actually of retaliation were actually dismissed. There were claims for the There were claims for the rent increase notice dated January of 2013, the rent increase notice dated November of 2013, the first 90-day notice to vacate, which is in February of 2014, and the 30-day notice to correct or vacate for nonpayment of rent, which is in Mr. Pearson's brief, is divided into two separate notices. There actually is only one. And a 30-day notice to correct or vacate for running a business out of the apartment. The filing of 2014 LTB 11162, which was based on those 30-day notices, and the filing of 2014 LTB 18410, which is based on the 90-day notice that was served in February. Mr. Pearson has alleged retaliation in the landlord-tenant case based on nonpayment of rent, which is 2014 LTV 11162. He's alleged retaliation as a defense, and it would, if he can prove that would be a defense. He is not going to be entitled before the Superior Court to fines because under Twyman versus Johnson, affirmative claims for retaliation cannot be brought in Superior Court. They could only come to this body. So what he's losing what he lost by not being able to assert those claims is simply that he can't seek a fine here for those specific acts. Although he did mention as an act of retaliation, the continuing to litigate this this lawsuit, 2014 LTV 11162, and that was specifically ruled against him by Judge Vergeer. So even though he was not technically allowed to raise the notices to vacate or the filing of the lawsuit, he actually was able to raise the existence of the lawsuit as a retaliatory act, and Judge Vergeer found that it wasn't. With respect to the 90-day notice to vacate, he was not allowed to challenge that specific 90-day notice to vacate or the lawsuit that was based on that, but he was permitted to challenge the 90-day notice that was issued in August of 2014, which corrected the error